from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, National Review editor Rich Lowry believes that if you get Lincoln right, you get America right. Lowry's latest book, Lincoln Unbound, accuses liberals of appropriating and body-snatching the beloved president and suggests that Lincoln should be viewed as a beacon of libertarianism and other conservative values. Reclaiming Lincoln's legacy, he argues, can help the GOP regain its mantle as a party of opportunity and aspiration. He joins us in the studio for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Rich Lowry joins us for this morning's second Forum Hour. Since 1997, he has been the editor of the National Review and is also a syndicated columnist, a commentator for Fox News, and author of Legacy, Paying the Price for the Clinton Years. He writes for Politico and Time and often appears on such public affairs programs as Meet the Press and Face the Nation. His most recent book is Lincoln Unbound, How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Saved the American Dream and How He Can Do It Again. And he joins us for this Forum Hour. And Rich Lowry, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you. I guess a place to begin here is with a quote that you use, if you get Lincoln right, you get America right. And the emphasis, I think, is on the right, isn't it? That Abraham Lincoln has been hijacked by, I don't know, Steven Spielberg, Tony Kushner, and progressives, that he's really a conservative and a libertarian and a real Republican.
Well, not quite. First of all, I think the movie is quite a good depiction of him and is probably the best depiction we'll ever have on film. I think the interpretation of the movie was off, was widely interpreted as a movie showing the glories of compromise and how politicians in Washington need to get together and cut a grand bargain when it was really about an act of principle. Abraham Lincoln obviously wanted to end slavery as a matter of principle, wanted the 13th Amendment as a matter of principle, and then he was very tactical and shrewd in how he got there. But if I just back up, my basic argument about Lincoln is what was most important about him was his rise in the world and how he wanted to make it possible for others to do the same in this country. So Lincoln is all about opportunity and aspiration that undergirds all of his policies and his politics. And then at the end of the book, I try to draw some lessons for today.
Well, you say early on in the book, we need to understand from other speeches, not just the second inaugural and the Gettysburg Address. You mentioned the Wisconsin State Agriculture Society speech and lecture on discoveries and inventions, that his thirst for economic and industrial development, realized he was a lawyer for corporations, a vigorous advocate of property rights, and a defender of an elitist economics against the unreflective populist bromides of his age. Sounds a little bit, in some respects, like maybe instead of Abe Lincoln the populist or Abe Lincoln the man who clearly President Obama wanted to evoke when he took that Bible in his first inaugural, we have maybe Abe Lincoln more with the Tea Party and more with conservatives.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, first of all, he doesn't, as I say in the book, easily fit in either of our contemporary political camps. And what President Obama can invoke about him, which is certainly true, is that he had a positive view of government, much more positive than any conservatives have today. But my argument about that is it was a much different kind of government. You didn't have any welfare state, obviously, which is a creation of FDR initially. You didn't have any transfer payments from some people to others. The government wasn't redistributive. There wasn't regulation. There wasn't an enormous federal bureaucracy. The primary expression of his government activism was aiding canals and railroads. And I think it's very important to understand the context of that, which really gets to the core of Lincoln. Where he grew up, it was basically a subsistence agricultural economy where there was no good way to get goods to market. If you were near a river, yes, you could get them to market. You could float them down the Mississippi all the way to New Orleans. And once they get to New Orleans, you can move them around the coast very easily. But prior to the era of steamboats, there was no good way to get back up the Mississippi. People would actually walk, some of them. The story is that Lincoln's father made this trip once or twice and walked back to Kentucky. So that's obviously not the predicate for a thriving or functioning market. And what happened was when the railroads touched those hinterland areas, instantly
they're transformed economically because you can buy manufactured goods from the East. You can buy clothing from the East. To do that, what do you need? You need cash. So then farmers begin growing for the market, and they might not even grow their own food anymore, right? Because that's not the most efficient crop, not the best cash crop. So instantly they're market players, and that's what the end that Lincoln was ultimately after, because he thought that created a more vibrant society when there are different ways for people to rise in the world. And he supported subsidies in various forms for these enterprises because they're very big in the context of the time, at a time when we didn't have financial markets to speak of, when we didn't have angel investors, we didn't have big industrialists. So if you wanted to get these things underway, you genuinely needed some element of government support. But the ultimate goal was enlivening and creating a market.
Yeah, we'll get back to that whole question of government control because it's become a big issue in the conjunction with your book. But you give us a profile of our 16th president and really the rough-hewn background that he came from, with bears and panthers and a mother and stepmother who signed with exes and beatings in school. Really isolation and a desire to escape from that, which I think from your perspective gives us a kind of Horatio Alger story. And at one point you say, maybe we don't have enough Horatio Alger-type stories in America. It's not mobile enough. Finland would be a better example, I think you've said.
Yeah, well, with Lincoln, it wasn't just the desire to escape it, which was central, but the desire to destroy it, right? He wanted to make an America where people didn't have to live that way ever again. Maybe they chose to live that way, fine. You know, you want to find some place where there are no railroads and you just want to tend your own garden, fine. But he didn't want to have to be that people like him, who were exceptionally talented, he must have realized from a very early age that he had an exceptional mind and there was something different about him, that people like him wouldn't have their opportunity blighted and wouldn't have to split rails their whole lives. And that's one of the great ironies of Abraham Lincoln. Our image of him is so caught up with the axe and the maw and the rail splitting, which is a great act of genius marketing when the Illinois Republicans made them their favorite son for president in 1860. And we've called him that ever since. It's in the subtitle of my book. But he never wanted to split another rail in his life. And if you really want a story that captures his ambition for himself and for the larger economy, he told this in the White House that as a young man, he had a rowboat side of the Ohio River. And two gentlemen come in with some luggage. They want to meet a steamboat coming down the middle of the river. They ask him to row them out. He does it. They get on the boat. They're about to steam off. He says, wait a minute, you didn't pay me. And to his shock and surprise, they both threw a silver half dollar down at the bottom of his rowboat. And he said in the White House decades later, so this obviously made a huge impression on him, I realized at that moment I had earned my first dollar.
That's a great story because I think you use it as a good—
I was a hopeful and optimistic being from that time.
Yeah, it's a good illustration from your perspective as an author of this book of how Lincoln dignified labor and rejected slavery because slavery was labor that should have been compensated. However, you're talking about Lincoln's image. The image also that most people have of Lincoln is one of honesty. As a kid, you know, I used to hear these stories like George Washington and Cherry Tree about how Abe Lincoln would walk miles to pay back a penny that he'd been given extra. But the also, in addition to honesty, it's an image of hard work and an image of freeing the slaves and emancipation. And yet he had this plan, for example, for Liberia to take many of our slaves, did he not?
Yeah. Yeah, his racial views in a contemporary context are quite appalling. But it's the context of the mid-19th century that matters. And if you look at some of the statements he made in the Lincoln-Douglas debate about I don't support civil rights, I just can't support civil rights for blacks, it looks horrible in isolation until you realize he's playing defense against a relentlessly race-baiting and low and demagogic argument from Stephen Douglas. And earlier at the outset of that campaign, there's a wonderful speech from Lincoln in Chicago where he concludes, let's stop quibbling about who's the superior and the inferior race and just all come back and honor those hallowed words in the Declaration that all men are created equal. So he was at the outer edge, especially in Illinois, of where you could be in terms of favoring rights for blacks. And he came back all the time just to natural rights that he thought were immutable and true for all time, that we are created equal and we had a right to the proceeds of our own labor. And he illustrated this point in a little fragment. He'd write these little speech fragments for himself that were little exercises in logic, really. And there's this wonderful little parable about an ant where he says, even the creepiest and crawlingest, lowest insect on the earth, an ant, if it finds a crumb and it works to drag that crumb to its nest, it understands that through its own labor that crumb now belongs to it. And if you try to take the crumb from that ant, it will fight you. And this is such a natural principle that there's no misunderstanding it unless it's in a self-interested or willful way, which is what he thought the South was doing.
Our guest is Rich Lowry. His new book is called Lincoln Unbound. It's actually a biography of Abraham Lincoln with a decided point of view, and he's the editor of the National Review. And I should add that outside of Jesus Christ, there have been more books written about Abraham Lincoln than probably anyone who has lived, not probably, but indeed anyone who's lived on the planet. And you give a different picture of him, Rich Lowry. I mean, in the sense you say, well, when it came to an activist government role, maybe Lincoln was in favor of canals and railroads for infrastructure and perhaps even government subsidies and land grants. But there's a whole argument that you've started here, and I'm interested in just getting your slant on it. And it started, I guess, in Politico with a piece by George Perkovich, the Carnegie Endowment, who said, well, Lincoln was attached to justice. He thought and believed that justice was important above all, and therefore government had to play a significant and integral role in seeing that justice, and that may even include economic equity, would be the law of the land.
Yeah, that was a fascinating and very well done piece that I appreciated. But I consider that piece confirmation as one of my arguments in the book, which is that if you want to get Lincoln as a modern, progressive, liberal enthusiast for the welfare state, you can't take anything that he actually said or believed at the time. You have to engage in some really deep reading of you know, various lines and try to stretch out their meaning to get them in that place. And look, I say in the book and I say in all the interviews, it's 150 years ago. He could have changed. You know, he could have become an FDR liberal during the Great Depression. Who knows? But if you just take him as you find him in the mid-19th century, I think he's a more comfortable fellow traveler, is the way I would put it, with the contemporary right than with the contemporary left.
You have to see him in the context of his time, though, of course.
Sure.
I mean, as you said earlier about race. Yeah.
Whig economics of the time, it's about 80% contemporary Republican economics. They worshipped property rights. Lincoln himself worshipped patent law, which he said was one of the three greatest inventions of all time. They thought in a functioning market, there's no such thing as a zero-sum transaction. They thought, to use an anachronism, that a rising tide lifts all boats. They opposed class warfare or redistribution for this reason. There's a famous statement from Lincoln when a delegation of working men came to visit him in the White House during the Civil War. He said, "Let not him who is houseless pull down the house of another, but let him labor diligently and build one of his own." That's a fundamentally Lincolnian sentiment. He oftentimes spoke of the race of life, which got to a certain competitive element to life. And in his view, that life is all about making the most of our potential and the most of our talents. And he said about slavery during the Lincoln-Douglas debates that it takes away, I won't use his exact language, but it takes away from the African-American the right to strive to be a man. Again, that's a Lincolnian sentiment. We're in striving. It's in striving that we become men and women.
Well, what about those angels of our better nature that he spoke of that frequently are cited and alluded to?
Wonderful, wonderful sentiment. I'm not sure you can take from that any particular policy or ideology in contemporary terms. But you know, the first inaugural was very conciliatory. He didn't want the South to go. He didn't want there to be a war. And the second inaugural was even better. You know, we know so many lines from that, and that got to a modesty about Lincoln and about God's purposes, because he was never an Orthodox Christian. Some evangelicals kind of try to posthumously enlist them in their cause. He was never an Orthodox Christian, I believe, but he did become more religious over time and under the pressure of events. And he was always, even when he was irreligious, soaked in the Bible. And under the pressure of the war and personal tragedy, he meditated more and more on God. And the brilliance of that second inaugural is that it's soaked with God. At the same time, it says we can't know his deepest purposes and have to have a certain modesty.
If he is, as you argue, the archetypical Republican, and if his leadership really provides the GOP survival as a party of aspiration, which I think is... You talk about him as a slashing partisan and a merciless polemicist and so forth. Where does this square, or does it square at all, with other things that have been soaked in the Bible, such as that have hurt the Republican Party, such as its stance on abortion or same-sex marriage? I mean, in terms of the future of the Republican Party, it's been tied in many people's minds more to stances like that, or for that matter, immigration, than it has to perhaps what we might associate with the Lincoln administration.
Yeah, you know, it depends on how you view abortion. If you view abortion, as I do, through the prism that all men are created equal and that life begins at conception, well, then you want to protect all life. And I don't presume to know what Lincoln would have thought of that question or gay marriage or immigration. I think all these things, though, the Republican Party can take a couple lessons from Lincoln. One is just the importance of being trying to be persuasive rather than denunciatory. Lincoln said in one of his great early addresses before anyone had heard of him, it's called the Temperance Address, that a drop of honey attracts more flies than a gallon of gall. And I think that's an important lesson for any politician or any statesman who wants to attract rather than repel people. And the other lesson is...
Oh, forgive me, Rich Lowry, if I could just jump in for a moment. Do you think that both parties have been too denunciatory rather than honey-coated or mellifluous in their sentiments?
Well, sure. I think any party feels the temptation just to speak to its base and sort of give vent to its righteousness. So I wouldn't say – if you look at an issue like abortion, I wouldn't say that it's just Republicans who are moralistic about it. Democrats are moralistic about it in their own way. Nancy Pelosi a week or so ago is quoted saying we shouldn't discuss abortion or it shouldn't even be a question because it's sacred ground, right? So what is that except if not by the very nature of it, a very moralistic statement, although one in favor rather than opposed to abortion rights?
Again, our guest is Rich Lowry. Lincoln Unbound is his book, subtitled How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Saved the American Dream and How We Can Do It Again. Lincoln is being compared, particularly from a Republican perspective, to presidents like Reagan and Nixon. And you make the point, and I think it's an important point, that he was perhaps unjustly compared to the likes of Andy Jackson, that was a mistake. But there's also, when we talk about the future of the Republican Party, there's a sense that figures and Ronald Reagan in the 20th century and up to the present is as iconic a figure as you can find in the GOP, that maybe even President Reagan, by today's standards of Republicanism, would be too liberal, and certainly Nixon would be too liberal, that they would be unacceptable in the party.
Well, Nixon would be unacceptable in the party, and I actually think that's a good thing. Reagan, though, I mean, if you look at the last two nominees of the Republican Party, they weren't unelectable purists. They were unelectable pragmatists, right? You have John McCain, who sticks his finger in the eye of the party on this hot-button issue of immigration, in that 06 and 07 period, and, went – he was genuinely – it's become kind of a word of mockery, but he was generally a maverick, and he gets nominated. And you have Mitt Romney, who a lot of conservatives didn't consider a conservative and had departed from party orthodoxy on healthcare and his healthcare bill in Massachusetts, and he got nominated. So at the presidential level, a Ronald Reagan would be just as nominatable now as he was in 1980. And, Reagan was an ideologue. You know, he had labored in the conservative vineyards for decades. But when he was actually in office as governor and as president, and this is another lesson that's very important for contemporary conservatives and very important for any political party, he exhibited that classic trait of statesmanship, which is having a fixed goal that's in accord with your principles or a few of them, but being very flexible in the way that you get there. And I think sometimes some of my fellow conservatives elevate tactical questions to a matter of high principle in a way that isn't very productive.
Well, how many times did Ronald Reagan raise taxes? I mean, that's a conservative principle, not to raise taxes under any circumstances, isn't it?
No, I mean, the principle is to lower them as much as you can, and he did lower them, you know, fundamentally. We're never going to go back to the highest rates that were in this country when he took office, but he, you know, he didn't felt as though he didn't have congressional support to resist giving some of the initial tax cut back. So he gave it back. I think he regretted it. It's not something he wanted to do, but it's something in the circumstances he felt he had to do.
So let's talk before we come to the break here and get our listeners involved in this, how we, and you mean the Republic and its citizens, can do it again. That is, bring the American dream back into the center and matrix of our lives. Make it viable.
Yeah, well, a couple things. One, I think, you know, there's been a lot of focus on inequality, and that's part of the picture, but I think inequality is basically inevitable in a free society, and I think the better metric is mobility, and I don't think we're doing very well there. Conservatives especially like to pat ourselves on the back about how we're the most mobile and fluid society on Earth. It's not true anymore. If, you know, these international comparisons can be a little tricky and complex, but Western Europe, other English-speaking countries, Scandinavian countries are doing better on mobility than we are. And that's the question of whether people at the bottom can get up the way Lincoln did. And I would like to focus on a kind of Lincolnian trinity of, one, how do you create a vibrant commercial economy? Two, how do you enhance education? And three, how do you restore what I call in the book kind of basic bourgeois values, things that make it easier for people to get ahead, work ethic, marriage, personal responsibility. And look, you can fill those three things in all sorts of in with all sorts of different ways and different policies. I have my policy preferences. Liberals would have theirs. But I think it's the only way to address as a nation this crisis of opportunity we have in the country is to focus on those three broad categories, I believe.
Well, you mentioned compromise before, and certainly Lincoln was pragmatist in many ways and was able to bring compromise into fruition. I'm just wondering whether you think, because things have become so polarized between so-called liberals and so-called conservatives, that any kind of real compromise or meeting of the minds and hearts can actually take place.
I don't think so. Not anything big in the short term.
Well, and you're not just talking about self-discipline and self-improvement here. You're talking about the big issue or personal responsibility. You're talking about the bigger issues, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the big budgetary issues. I mean, we sort of had a kind of crazy quilt compromise, right? Because in negotiations over the fiscal cliff, the president gets pretty much what he wants, $700 billion tax increase with no spending cuts whatsoever, even though he oftentimes or all the time says we need a balanced approach. But when he had a chance just to raise taxes, he was very eager to do that. And then you have the sequester, which is not the ideal way to cut government spending by any means whatsoever. But in that negotiation, Republicans sort of had the whip hand because it was inevitable. So you had that spending cut. So we've had a little bit of a tax increase. We've had a little bit of a spending cut. And the bigger question is how you're going to or if you're going to reform entitlements over time. And on that, just the parties have a big division and the public has a big division. And I just think hoping that there will be some compromise on that is a forlorn one.
And again, our guest, Rich Lowry, the editor of the National Review. And let's bring our listeners into this. You might want to weigh in on Abraham Lincoln, weigh in on the future of the Republican Party, or really what he's talking about, which is the future of the United States and its citizens. Our toll-free number is available, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Rick Lowry, who is the editor of the National Review and also the author of Lincoln Unbound, How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Saved the American Dream and How We Can Do It Again. And we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available to you. Again, it's 866-733-6786. Number of other ways to communicate with us, email forum@kqed.org or our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or you can go to our Facebook page. And, well, you've stirred the bushes here, Rich Lowry, which I suppose was predictable. Let me give you a sampling of what some of the listeners are saying.
Sure.
Listener writes,
hit me.
Hit you with their best shot, so to speak. Huh? Pat Benatar. Lincoln, a libertarian, he'd been a Whig whose National Party platform notably favored federal infrastructure projects, internal improvements, with money raised by imposing a high tariff on imports, something the most wealthy capitalists of the era, the slave plantation owners, hated. Lincoln's government passed the Homestead Act, which gave to poor people the opportunity to settle land and become property owners. Lincoln would not understand today's Republican Party. To see how far today's party is from Lincoln's, read Lincoln's first inaugural address. What really seems to be going on here is an ideological project.
Yeah, well, I never depict Lincoln as a libertarian. I mean, obviously wasn't a libertarian for the reasons that the emailer cited and that we talked about a little earlier in the program. So it's definitely true that the Republican Party has taken a more libertarian tack and has a more Jacksonian negative attitude towards government. But again, government is different than it was in Lincoln's day in fundamental ways. And if all the government did at the moment was fund infrastructure projects, well, then the federal government would take about, I don't know, what, 0.5% of GDP to do that. And we basically have no government whatsoever, which goes to how, as a practical matter, most Republicans, short of Ron Paul today, support a much greater level of government than Lincoln ever would have imagined. Paul Ryan's budget, which is kind of the Republican ideal at the moment, I think would take federal spending to about 18% of GDP, which is still enormous. And on the Homestead Act, just two things on that. One is kind of interesting. Lincoln was a late adopter of the Homestead Act, and this went to his anti-agrarianism. He didn't really want to encourage people to go out on the land because, again, as we discussed, that was something he escaped himself. But I would look at the Homestead Act as a giant act of privatization, basically, where you have something owned by the government. It's put into individual hands for the individuals to make the most of on their own.
Well, let me give you a sampling. As I said, there's been some real blowback from listeners here. Chris writes, yes, it's the liberals' fault. This despite the fact that Republicans hate the federal government, which Lincoln venerated. Next book by Lowry will be about Teddy Roosevelt, too, and how liberals stole him, all that federal land and environmental protection. See, conservatives care about the environment because Roosevelt did 100 years ago. And Richard writes, Lincoln would be right there with Rick Perry and Rick Scott, making sure as few African Americans can vote as possible, wouldn't he? And Christine tweets, using all men are created equal to justify being pro-life is the most ill-conceived justification I have ever heard. Now, admittedly, you're here in the Bay Area on the airwaves, and this is public radio, but there's a lot of really what I would almost characterize as anger. For example, Pete tweets, and this is a bit ad hominem, to put it mildly. He says, Lincoln was a mindful, contemplative, intelligent man. The Tea Party and GOP are mindless ideologues. There is no relation. Or a listener writes, why is a rising tide lift all boats a conservative slogan? I think of Bill Clinton while the Republican corollary is trickle down. He puts out all these maxims to show Lincoln is a conservative, but this presumes the liberals are communists. Democrats embrace these axioms as well.
Yeah, okay, Michael, there's a lot there. I'm not sure I can take it all on, but there are some Republicans, again, Ron Paul, who basically want no federal government. But again, the primary Republican budget document wants a government that takes up 18% of GDP as a matter of federal spending, which is basically somewhere around historic norms. So that's still a heck of a lot of government. And I think people have this view that Republicans want to eliminate the federal government entirely for two reasons. One, it's kind of liberal stereotyping and creating straw men. But two, in fairness, there are people on my side of the aisle who basically rhetorically write these anarcho-libertarian
checks that they're never going to cash. You know, so if you want to change Medicare so you slow its growth and have an element of individual choice that isn't there at the moment, it's as though you're eliminating Medicare, when of course you're not. There's still going to be this enormous federal health care program. You're just going to change it around the edges, basically, at least from a pure libertarian perspective. That's what you're doing, because you're still going to have this enormous federal intervention. So I think that's a bit of a straw man. Mindless, obviously. I don't consider conservatives and Republicans mindless. I edit a conservative magazine. If you ever actually pick it up and read it, you'll see they're actually quite thoughtful people on the other side of the aisle. And this is just an irritating thing that I encounter whenever I go on a liberal forum. You know, there are thoughtful people who disagree with you, who have a different point of view. They're not all evil or stupid. And it's one of the great ironies of our political life that the people who imagine themselves being the most tolerant and broad-minded can't get their heads around. There's actually a sincere and good faith opposite point of view.
But that's why I described that particular thought as ad hominem. Let me bring some callers on here. Colin, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Is it a really speculative argument to state that Lincoln would have been aligned with the Tea Party, the Republican Party, considering that essentially the Republican Party is now a regional party, a party of white Southern men and not a national party? Lincoln, I think, would have been appalled at Mitch McConnell stating that his one goal was to ensure that Obama was a one-term president rather than recovering from the greatest recession that we'd ever seen. Likewise, I think Lincoln would have been appalled at the cheers that Newt Gingrich got from the Republican primary audiences, calling Obama a food stamp president, a coded appeal to racism, if I'd ever heard it.
Yeah, well, first of all, in terms of Republicans being a regional party, I mean, they do control the House of Representatives, which last time I checked is a national body, as is the Senate, which they have a very good chance to take in next year's elections. We'll see whether they do or not. And I think people misunderstand the history of the Republican Party and the South. They focus on Barry Goldwater's opposition to the Civil Rights Act, which I think was wrong, but it was a principled position he took. And he won, you know, four states in the Deep South and Arizona, and that was it. And that was clearly people voting for him based on his opposition to the Civil Rights Act. But that was a bit of an outlier in terms of the Republican Party's growth in the South. That wasn't the first time Republicans had begun to make inroads in what had been a solid Democratic segregationist South. The first inroads were in 1952 when Dwight Eisenhower, which by no means a George Wallace-type figure, began to win the border states and began to win among the voters who would create the new South.
Yeah, but excuse me, Rich, the real triumph of the South came during Nixon's administration with John Mitchell's strategy of winning over the South, did it not?
But the Republicans didn't win a majority of Southern House seats until 1994, when the South had been utterly transformed. And if you look at the South today, economically, arguably the most dynamic region in the country, with some of the most vibrant cities in the country, with an open economy that's attracting manufacturing and attracting immigrants. This is the kind of South and the kind of country that Lincoln wanted to create all along. So now you have Republicans actually winning in this open and dynamic South, and it's supposed to be proof somehow that it's violated the principles of Lincoln or turned its back on Lincoln. I just think it's nonsense.
Let me thank the caller. Bring another caller right on. And Ron, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Good morning. Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Rich. Rich, I have to take issue with you on a couple of items here. Now, let me say,
Please, first of all,
that I look at Lincoln with a mixture of reverence and horror, which is probably the right way to look at what America went through under him. But in light of his views on homesteading, for example, and the agrarian life, was one of the reasons that Lincoln, who was a great follower of Henry Clay, a disciple, you may say, wanted railroads was to help the agrarian economy be more prosperous by moving the goods to market. He was very much in the Locke liberal tradition that all men had a right to property, which was why he came to be a supporter of the Homestead Act. He was also a virulent opponent to the War of Mexico and the annexation of Texas. He was, I wouldn't call him a pacifist, but he was not all that thrilled by America's conduct with respect to, you know, war and to some degree with Native Americans. I despise both parties, but I got to tell you, your take on Lincoln, probably the most revised figure since Jesus, doesn't wash.
Rich Lowry.
Okay. Well, look, you're absolutely right. He revered property rights. Again, that was a key part of Whig and early Republican economics. And you go back and look at the economic thinkers that Lincoln and his Whigs read and took their guidance from, Francis Wayland and Henry Carey, I believe, is the other one, but I'm a little addle-brained at the moment. And 80% of it is standard kind of free market Republican economics. So again, the fundamental break in American history was not Lincoln and Lincoln supporting land grants for railroads. It was the New Deal and the rise of progressivism. So you can say, oh, Lincoln would have supported all that stuff, but there's no actual evidence of it in the historical record because it's something entirely new. War on Mexico, he was famously opponent of it. The caller is also absolutely right about that. He gives the famous, you know, spot speech on the House floor, which he is ridiculed for back home. But Lincoln obviously wasn't a pacifist given the what happened during his presidency. And the context of his stalwart opposition to that war is a Southern drive for more slave territory. And one of his biggest strategic goals is to limit the expansion of slavery. And Henry Clay has come up several times. Henry Clay is known as the great compromiser. Lincoln wasn't the great compromiser, at least on that question. You know, when secession winter, when the first seven Southern states go, and there are all these proposals for compromise floating around Washington, Lincoln was willing to countenance a lot of them, except for the expansion of slavery. He said, on that, give no ground. And on that, the tug must come. And it did.
And let me thank Ron for his call. And where do you think he would have stood? That is, Abraham Lincoln would have stood on the immigration issue and the reform legislation. Any idea to divine that?
I can't presume to say where he would be on a specific piece of legislation. I do think, though, we can know with some certainty his attitude towards illegal immigrants, because there are a couple key phrases he repeated again and again. One is that they're just the way we would be in their circumstance. And this is something he said about slave owners. And it was a guard against moralizing on his own side, where he would basically say it's very easy in the North if you have no slaves to oppose slavery. It's quite another matter if you're a plantation owner and you've had slaves in your family for generations and all your wealth is caught up in it, then it's going to look different to you. And if you were in their circumstances, you might think differently. So it was, again, a check against moralism. And the other thing he said often is that you're no better or no worse than anyone else. He goes that you mentioned Michael Wright at the beginning of the program, this speech to the Wisconsin Agricultural Fair. And it's hard to imagine anyone doing this in, you know, at the Iowa caucuses now. But he stands up and says in front of all these farmers and says, I don't pander to farmers as a class. You're no better and no worse than anyone else. On his way to Washington, famously, after he's elected, he addresses German Americans and tells them, you know what? You're no better. You're no worse than anyone else. So clearly he'd have that attitude toward illegal immigrants. Most of us, I think, if you're an ambitious person and you were caught somewhere in Mexico and you had no opportunity to rise and you had this dynamic colossus to the north that didn't really care about its immigration laws, you very well might go too. And I can see Lincoln making that case. So I think he'd have a very generous attitude towards illegals. He worshipped lawfulness, though. So where he would come down ultimately, I mean, because that's the choice here is how much do you honor our laws and how much do you want to forgive people who broke our laws. But I suspect, I can't prove it, he'd have a pretty liberal take on this proposal.
Well, here's a supporter, Rich. Rick from Palo Alto.
Oh, thank goodness.
Rick from Palo Alto writes, wouldn't you agree that everyone in 1860 would be considered a conservative relative to our time? You could imagine bringing back from 1860 a random sample of 1,000 people and then interviewing the sample point by point, and I'm certain that there would be little overlap with current status liberal instincts, and we do not even have to consider social issues for this to be true. Three cheers for Rich Lowry. I'm a longtime reader of your magazine, A Shocking Thought in the Bay Area.
How about that? Well, I think that's a a good point, but I would just make one addendum to that. You know, the arguments about banks and corporations, they're all about favoring the rich and the top of society, and that's not fair. Those arguments were made at that time. And if Lincoln wanted to take that view was perfectly available to him at that time. And he didn't take it, and he strongly rejected it. So it is partly that everyone in that context relative today is more conservative, but it's also that this divide and this economic argument was already present at that time, and Lincoln was not on President Obama's side of that particular argument.
But you've said he was certainly a strong believer, profoundly, in upholding the law, and yet we have, I think what you would probably concede, are some pretty strong loopholes in those laws that allow people not to necessarily use the language of the left, pay their fair share, but certainly get away with a lot of things in terms of offshore declarations and the like that doesn't mean paying what they should be paying.
Yeah, I'm not a tax expert, or an expert on, you know, corporate law or corporate governance. My basic tendency in all this stuff is to have simple rules for a complex society. So, the simpler tax code you would have, I think, the better, and the less potential there is for abuse by various insiders. And in terms of the banks, I would just have very stringent capital requirements and probably toss out most of Dodd-Frank and just leave it at that.
Would you have taxes for hedge funds, for example? Because there are none presently.
What do you mean?
I mean, you can actually, if you have a hedge fund, you can bank against paying taxes. The system is pretty much set that way.
Again, I would have the simple rules with as few loopholes for people to take advantage of as possible.
You like Steve Forbes, single tax?
Flat tax?
Flat tax?
No,
yeah.
I'm not quite a flat taxer. I just don't think the politics work, because basically to have a flat tax, you have to raise taxes on middle-class people, and I don't think that's going to go over very well, and that's something that the Republican Party should avoid at all costs. I think you can simplify and you can lower rates, but I am with some of my colleagues who argue very strongly that the tax code and basically the entire welfare state is kind of tilted against parents and child rearing, where you have some people bearing the costs of raising children and making them into productive citizens who then go on to pay into the welfare state and fund everyone else. So you'd want to have as a pro-parent tax system as possible, which would mean a bigger child tax credit.
And we'll bring Stephen on. Stephen, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Hi, this is a little parenthetical, but your guest made a parenthetical remark about a comment that Nancy Pelosi made. Could you repeat that just so that everybody can be clear at your point about Nancy Pelosi and abortion?
I believe you'll have to go and look it up, because I might be not getting it exactly right, but she said something like, you know, abortion is sacred ground. And she was being questioned about whether there should be any restrictions on abortion at all. At least I believe that was the context. But the point was that this is a question that really should be beyond dispute, and abortion sort of has a hallowed place in our national life.
Thank you, Stephen, for the call. And Michelle writes, if Rich Lowry admires the social and economic mobility of Northern Europe, what does he attribute that to? I attribute it to the type of government policies that Rich Lowry seems to disagree with.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I attribute it to a social breakdown that's happening in the country. I think you've seen the breakdown of marriage, for instance, where you have, if you divide the country into thirds by level of education, if you take the people top third who have a college degree or more, they are living, you know, modernized, but kind of a version of Leave It to Beaver type existence. The out of wedlock child bearing rate is 6%, which probably in national terms, that was probably what we had in 1950 or something. They get married. They tend to stay married. You know, divorce has declined. They spend less leisure time than they used to. Then they spend more time with their kids. than they did before. So these are parents who are just intensely cultivating their children and passing along attitudes and habits that are very important to success in American life. And if you take the middle slice, people with a high school degree and some college but not a college degree, what's kind of the solid middle of America, the rate, out of wedlock rate was about 14% in 1982. Now it's 44%, so it's almost half. And it is that middle slice is much closer to the lower end on a whole range of social measures like that. And this isn't to condemn or moralize, although I know probably most of your listeners, Michael, will hear it that way, but it just makes it much harder for mothers and fathers. It makes it much harder for children if the mother and father aren't there together. And this is where I think you have a risk of a class divide that over time could become unbridgeable in this country, because you have the social trends, then you also have the economic trends associated with globalization. And we can't be a class society. You know, we'll still be called America, we'll still be rich, we'll still be powerful, but we won't be the America that we once were, and we won't be the America that we should be.
You know, the old cliche is that class division is America's dirty little secret, but you take the position rather strongly that Nixon rejected what you call class warfare, which in itself is a fairly broad rubric. But what do you mean by that?
That Lincoln did.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry, you said Nixon.
I said Nixon? Well, that's a strange Freudian slip. No, I meant to say Lincoln.
That's my next book, Michael.
Well, what do you mean when you say he rejected class warfare? How do you substantiate that?
Well, he loved banks. He was a great warrior in favor of banks. He once jumped out of a window to try to save the Bank of Illinois in a misbegotten parliamentary maneuver. He was on retainer for the biggest corporation in the state of Illinois, the Illinois Central Railroad. And he believed that individuals, and there are stirring statements over and over again by him to this effect, that individuals have the right to do with the fruit of the labor whatever they please. And he said, I don't oppose a law to keep people from getting rich. It would do more harm than good. And actually, people getting rich is a good example for everyone else. So again, on this stuff, I think you can draw a direct connection to today. And President Lincoln, I think, would be repelled by that speech that President Obama gave out in Kansas in the end of 2011. I believe it was, when he basically said the rich are a clear and present danger to our democracy and to our economy.
Well, let me also get you on the record on something else here. I want to get back to Lincoln, of course. It's a fascinating discussion. But you recently wrote on the DOMA decision, and I'm quoting here directly, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy has contempt for a swath of his fellow citizens. In the end, Kennedy simply declares the supporters of DOMA hateful people. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you read the decision, there's some federalism throat clearing at the beginning, but then the balance of the decision and the force of the decision comes from the argument that there is no reason to oppose gay marriage except for irrational animus. So this is Justice Kennedy saying not quite half of the country anymore, because obviously public opinion has been trending in favor of gay marriage, but 40% or so have this irrational animus towards gay people. And I think that one is wrong. Two is not the role of the Supreme Court. And if you want to overturn DOMA, that's fine. They're very good arguments for overturning DOMA. Go and have a vote in Congress to do it. Don't have the Supreme Court do it. And I fear that this line of reasoning will create the predicate down the line for impinging on the free speech rights of organizations, traditional faith organizations that have a more traditional view of the morality of homosexuality.
Again, if you've just joined us, our guest is Rich Lowry. He is the author of Lincoln Unbound. He's also editor of the National Review and a fellow editor of yours who wishes you good luck with your book writes the following. Mr. Lincoln was the original big government progressive and believed in extensive government regulation of the economy, especially the financial system. To be sure, he believed in individual initiative, but repeatedly stated that the role of government was to do for the individual what he could not do for himself. From his earliest days as a frontier field hand, the young Abraham Lincoln supported liberal causes, often at great political cost to himself. This included supporting the first bank of the United States, the nation's first financial regulator, advocating free government land for family farmers and backing mammoth jobs programs, example, building the Transcontinental Railroad. Later as president, he introduced the nation's first income tax on the wealthy and funded new public colleges in the states, of which California has several land-grant colleges. Rich Lowry.
Yeah, well, supporting banks wasn't a liberal position. It was a Hamiltonian position, and I don't think Alexander Hamilton, from whom the Whigs were roughly descended, was a liberal by any stretch of the imagination. The Transcontinental Railroad, again, there wasn't the private capital to build a transcontinental railroad, I don't believe, and plus the conditions wouldn't have been favorable to it because you were going through unorganized territory where there are still hostile Indians. So it was a little bit like a more like a space shot than, you know, the average bridge you're going to build. And yes, there are libertarians who probably say there should be no such thing as NASA and it was a disastrous mistake to go to the moon. But most people would support government enterprises of that nature, which are different in kind from the welfare state and, you know, massive transfer payments from some individuals to others. The income tax at a time of war, you have to pay for a war, and when the war ends, the income tax goes away, as does almost all the spending, not all of it. You know, the level that the spending went down to was still higher than pre-war levels. But again, none of this, I think, gets you to a place where Lincoln is a progressive.
Well, now with just seconds left, you mentioned income tax. I'm looking at an email from a listener named Bill who says it's a little known fact that the first president to ask for and get an income tax was Lincoln in order to pay the government's bills accrued during the Civil War. Although it was dropped after those bills were paid, I can't think of anything more un-Republican than levying an income tax on American workers and business owners.
Well,
I think he's right on his facts there.
Yeah, he is. Except for I don't know whether the Confederacy went first. The Confederacy had an income tax too, actually a more progressive income tax. And actually, ironically, if you look at the Confederate economy, it was much more socialistic than the Northern economy. But again, you had a national crisis, country's existence threatened, and you had to pay for it. Paid for it some through an income tax and a lot through debt.
That'll bring us to the conclusion, Rich Lowry. Good of you to spend your time with us. I thank you. Congratulations on the book and good luck with it.
Thank you so much. And thanks so much for all the thoughtful, if not uncritical, questions.
And Rich Lowry, again, is the editor of the National Review magazine. His book is Lincoln Unbound. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zolin, our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.